and our own capacity to thrive is reduced. And I view orcas and salmon as both very integral threads.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Democrats have propelled Kamala Harris to the top of the ticket in this year's presidential race. But nationwide, the number of women running for office in November, both as Democrats and Republicans, is down. As Roz Brown reports, that follows three cycles of historic firsts for women elected to office, including in New Mexico.
Earlier this year, Mexico elected the first woman president in the country's 200-year history, and Kamala Harris hopes to duplicate that milestone in the U.S., but a group that studies how women fare in elections says it's still an uphill battle. Harris already is America's first female vice president, and the first Black and South Asian American to hold the office. Kelly Dittmar with the Center for American Women and Politics says in addition to gender and race attacks, Harris will face criticism for her style, with some claiming she's not presidential.
We've also seen attacks on Harris's qualifications, something more common to women and especially to women of color, whose competencies are more often questioned, while for white men, they are more often assumed.
In 2020, New Mexico became the first state to elect all women of color to its House delegation. The group included Democratic incumbent Representative Deb Haaland, who now leads the Department of the Interior. Center Director Debbie Walsh says the number of women running for federal office has fallen off nationally in both political parties. That follows numerous successes, especially at the gubernatorial level.
Women have been essential to flipping the most competitive seats in recent election years, and women of color have been winning both statewide executive and legislative seats in states and districts with majority white electorates.
The last two New Mexico governors have been women, Republican Susana Martinez and current Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, a Democrat. In this year's race, two of New Mexico's three U.S. House incumbents seeking re-election are women. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 29th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Grant Button, Grace Brenson, Reed Johnson, Bat Patches, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and engineer is Patches. Special thanks to Eric Takeitoff, Mason Kennedy, Nadia Romlagon, Catherine Carley, Roz Brown, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. Okay. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sabine Mercer.
And I'm Grant Button. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. The New England Journal of Medicine recently featured a study that is the first to show the implications of adopting race-neutral equations when doctors are testing for lung function. What's known as race adjustment is a routine practice that assumes that Black patients have lower lung capacity than white patients. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with James Diao, a medical student at Harvard and MIT and a co-author of the study, and with Raj Munrai, an assistant professor of biomedical informatics at Harvard Medical School. They talked about race-neutral tests and the significance of this study.
Lung function and race neutrality Why don't we start with you, Raj? Is this something that's been a controversial issue at all over the years?
It really has. So I think there's been a lot of work, especially by scholars like Lundy Braun, that have examined whether this process and this practice of race adjustment is appropriate. But it wasn't until a few years ago where the leading group, the Global Lung Initiative, released a new race-neutral equation. And so this has been controversial. It's been, you know, in practice for some time, and the history actually goes back much further than that. It has been controversial, but it isn't until the past few years where we've really seen a change in the way that race is operationalized or using these equations. And, you know, our paper is really about quantifying the implications of this recent change.
James, is this only about lung function, or does it cover other areas as well?
So this study in the New England Journal of Medicine is only about lung function, but the controversy extends far beyond that. And our research has also extended beyond that. And so Raj was talking about how the controversy for lung function has existed for a long time, but really picked up steam in the last several years. And I'd say that's true across all of medicine. Just after the murder of George Floyd, there was an increasing turn of attention to how race is used in medicine. And we've seen just this enormous response where Congress got involved and asked for statements from the presidents of the different medical societies. Different activists and advocates have submitted petitions to different hospitals. Hospitals have changed the way that they evaluate patients based on this feedback. And all the different medical societies have been trying to think about how they've been using race in these equations in the past and how they should move forward with them. And so our work here in lung function and across these other domains is to try to provide data so that these different policymakers, hospitals, clinicians, and so on are aware of what's at stake and can make decisions accordingly.
Raj, how would you summarize how the medical profession has viewed lung function as far as looking at the different racial groups?
So the practice of race adjustment, which until 2022, when a race-neutral equation was introduced, the practice of race adjustment, which has been the standard, effectively assumes that differences that we observe in different race groups are benign and normal, and that different race groups have different inherent lung function. And that is a axiomatically problematic assumption, right? It assumes that these differences that we see are normal, are quote-unquote normal, right? And so the switch away from race adjustment towards this race-neutral composite equation reflects this desire to move away from these crude proxies like race and to really try to better understand what is actually potentially driving these differences that we observe between different race groups.
And they were not making a distinction between male and female here.
Yeah, so they actually do. So the equations are basically trying to define what's normal for you based on age, sex, height, and until recently, race. And so the idea is, you know, what we mean by lung function is really how much air you can blow out of your lungs in 1 second or in one full breath. And so if I blow out 4 liters and someone else blows out 4 liters, let's say my grandmother blows out 4 liters, that 4 liters might not mean the same thing for both of us. And so based on our differences in sex and age and so on, they'll adjust that number to interpret it properly. And the big question that the field is grappling with for the last couple of years is whether race should be one of these things that we adjust for.
What about other countries? Do they have the same sort of system, or are they, in your view, more advanced or less advanced?
So the equation that we are evaluating was developed by the Global Lung Function Initiative. And so this is a set of equations that is designed to be used globally. And to my knowledge, it is the one that's recommended by most of the respiratory societies in the US and Europe and other places. And in, I think, also Australia and parts of Asia as well. And so it is definitely a global phenomenon. I'm not sure exactly how extensive that reaches. But the history of it actually is that race was first used as an organizing principle in the United States. And back in Europe at the time, it was primarily around occupation. And then it was only over time that the development of a race-stratified lung function equation for global use appeared around 2012. And then from there, it was removed about last year. And so it has definitely been evolving. But the stuff that we are studying is of an equation that's recommended for use globally.
Raj, would you say there's a certain mythology around race and lung function? Would you say that similar to, when people talk about athletics and how some people are naturally better at certain things, that kind of thing?
I do think that what the way that race was operationalized or has been operationalized in this equation, it does have this inherent assumption that these differences are different between different race groups. But I also think at the same time, there's a big education gap. And I think a lot of physicians and a lot of patients don't fully appreciate how race is being used today in their care. James just referenced the global and some of the other countries and their society guidelines and recommendations. But I think it's important also to emphasize that there's guidelines and then there's actual clinical practice, right? And sometimes clinical practice doesn't match guidelines. And I think what's amazing and what we've learned in talking to pulmonologists and other doctors is that there is a lot of misunderstanding or just confusion or not even awareness almost of the fact that race is embedded in many clinical decision algorithms. So I think, yes, there is this kind of implicit assumption, right, that different race groups have different normal lung function. And I think if you ask many physicians, though, at the same time, are they even aware of how race is being used in lung function, but also in other clinical equations or many patients, I think they would be surprised to learn that there's a race group that's sort of checked off, oftentimes filled out by the physician. So the physician's assessment of the patient's race, and then use the index what's normal or not normal variation. I think part of our message, and really I think what our findings reveal, is that there are massive implications for using race or for this common practice of race adjustment. And those are not just clinical, but they're financial and they're occupational as well. I also think part of the message here is an educational one, which is just to make people aware that race is being used and that it's not a trivial decision, and that the use of race in these algorithms can really, really affect care. But what we're constantly surprised by, and I think James said it really well, is that, yes, there's been a lot of attention and focus for the past few years, but I think a lot of people are still surprised that race is even being used in these ways to change care.
Yeah, we have heard about it in terms of the care of Black women, for example, when they're pregnant.
Yeah.
So I don't know how fast or if that's going to change at all. But do you see, as far as your issue is concerned, that there will be positive change in the near future?
Yeah, I think we don't have hard data yet on the uptake of the new GLI global equations across the country and around the world. But I think if we're to look at other organ systems, so James has led a lot of work in my group on kidney function, and we have a few year sort of head start, if you will, because the equation changed in 2020 and then again with national guidelines behind it in 2021. And I think if you look at some of the surveys that came out of testing labs, even about a year later or so, following that recommendation change to remove race from the kidney function equations, there was widespread and relatively quick, certainly by, I think, clinical practice standards, uptake of the new equation. So my guess is that the American Thoracic Society, the European Respiratory Society, they've already recommended this new GLI global equation. I think we've heard anecdotally from some of the testing labs here at Harvard and Boston at the affiliated hospitals and from some of the labs that we've spoken with outside of Boston that they're already using the GLI global equation. But we've also heard, and James and I were at the American Thoracic Society meeting a few weeks ago presenting these results, we also heard from some testing labs that were completely unsure and they wanted to work with us to potentially look at the impact and plan for the impact of the switch to the race neutral equation in their population. And so I think there is, as with all practice changes and recommendation changes, there is what's recommended, what's in guidelines, and what actually happens in practice, and that sort of diffusion of recommended care and diffusion of innovation or new equations can be both fast in some places and slow generally at the same time.
James, has there been much pushback on this? Are there people in the medical profession saying, we like our system just fine, it works, that kind of thing?
Yeah, Absolutely. And I think this is it's controversial because there are opinions on both sides about what the best way is to move forward. And I think the pushback largely comes from those who point to the true observation that if you measure lung function in, for example, Black adults and white adults, you do see a difference of about maybe 10 to 15% in the lung function. And so from their point of view, if you see this difference and you want to have an equation that's really accurate for predicting it, then using an equation that accounts for race will get that accuracy number higher. But I think the step where I tend to disagree is this question of whether that means that it should be included in the equation and adjusted for, because when we're adding it to the equation, we're not really trying to predict anything. We're really trying to say what is normal for this one person. And so if we're saying that for this person, like an a healthy, normal lung for a Black person is different from a healthy, normal lung for a white person, that's something that is not necessarily well supported. And when we don't have data that really explains why there's this difference that we observe, it seems like not a good idea to adjust that difference away without knowing exactly what we're controlling for and whether we're sort of baking in these structural problems, like, for example, poor nutrition or exposure to air pollution that ends up causing some of these differences, and just calling these differences normal.
And what about if someone was in the military where they're exposed to a lot of toxic chemicals? Was that factored in at all?
No. So these are not things that are factored in, but I think that would be a good analogy. So, for example, if you were to look at people who served in the military and didn't serve in the military, you'd probably observe a difference, but you wouldn't necessarily want to say that, you know, people who served in the military just happen to have naturally smaller lungs, and therefore, you know, your lungs are small, but they're not small for a veteran. So we're not going to give you a diagnosis. We're not going to give you compensation. We're not going to XYZ because it's not small for a veteran. And that's something that is clearly inappropriate in that context. And then perhaps a similar argument could be made for adjusting by race.
Either of you have anything else you'd like to add?
James, do you want to talk about the trade-offs and maybe a clinical example?
Of course. What our study does is it looks at how many people, when you add or remove race, are pushed across thresholds that are used to decide important things. So, for example, whether they have a disease or not, or how bad that disease is, whether they qualify for compensation, if so, how much. And one interesting thing is that these thresholds, they're really negotiating between benefit and harm. So, for example, if you're one study that got a lot of attention last year was looking at the effects of using or not using race for lung function in deciding who gets lung cancer surgery. Because if their lung function is really poor, then you're going to put the patient at additional risk by taking out a bigger piece of the lung. So you're trying to trade between the benefit of getting the tumor out versus the harm of getting rid of extra lung that they might need to breathe. So when you reclassify people to getting the surgery or no longer getting the surgery based on which equation you use, it's actually not entirely clear if they benefit or not, because there's benefits and harms in either direction. And the same is true, for example, of qualifying someone for a job that might hurt their lungs, but also might provide a six-figure salary that they need to support their families, and so on. And so for these types of questions, I think it's not entirely clear to be able to point to, you know, people benefit, or this is better for people, this is worse for people, but rather a lot of people are reclassified, a lot of people are affected, and more study is needed to determine exactly whether these changes are desirable or not.
I totally agree with what James just said. I also think that one of the key groups who it's important for, I think, physicians and even patients to be aware of is that sometimes as a result of the switch to an equation, you know, there might be an individual who's kind of right near a decision cutoff or a threshold. And those are the same thresholds that we use in the paper to estimate the population level effects. But for folks who are kind of near the threshold or reclassified effectively using one equation versus the other for either occupational eligibility, for financial compensation, or for diagnosing respiratory disease like COPD or asthma, I think a lot of clinicians use, you know, many other types of tests and sort of a full clinical picture to also understand the individual risk and what's actually what's going on in the individual. And I think it's in many ways also emblematic of what this switch away or this move away from race is broadly across medicine, which is a move away from these coarse and, you know, imprecise group level proxy variables to understand what is going on with the individual. So what is race standing in for? You know, as James said, environmental exposure, childhood exposure, genetics, molecular markers, other things that are really at much more at the individual level that we want to understand to know what's healthy, what's disease, and what's normal for that person.
So would you say it's kind of an anachronism to use race in that way, or is
I think we're seeing it across medicine, right? So we saw it with kidney disease, we saw it with lung disease. There's a new equation for predicting cardiovascular risk, which is not guideline recommended, but is, I think, likely to be guideline recommended. And across many areas, and, you know, James, there's several others, right? VBAC, for example, right? Many other calculators that have historically used race have moved away from race over the past few years. And I think that's a good step. What I think James and I are also seeing in our work and in our future work is that it's a step, but we really need to move even more precise, more accurate, more individual level risk prediction and really improve these risk equations by finding out what those individual level factors are that are changing values and changing what we see on these tests that patients have when they go visit their doctor. And the sort of broad movement in medicine, I think one of the nice terms or categories, if you will, is this movement towards precision medicine. And so you might hear about this concept of precision medicine in like a cancer screening context or cancer treatment context, where patients with lung cancer, you know, lung cancer can be many different things, right? It can be caused by many different individual genetic variants or other factors. And knowing what specific factors are the cause of a patient's cancer can really change, and sometimes very dramatically, their response to therapy and what therapy, specific therapy we would prescribe for those patients. And so it's really, we want to do that just, you know, not only on the treatment side, but I think what James's work and what we are seeing and what I think this movement reflects also is that even in thinking about diagnosis or in how we define thresholds or understand risk, we want to move much more to individual level precise factors. I think it's also worth emphasizing here in, you know, kidney function equations, also with lung function, there's a lot of work to do to improve these equations. And there's a lot of imprecision or variance left to be explained, if you will, or existing imprecision in the equations, whether or not race is used in those equations. So I think there's a lot of work ahead of us, but I think the future is to us much more individual level and much more sort of computational integration of many different parts of the individual's data to improve risk prediction.
And would a doctor would use intuition as well in kind of figuring out what a certain...
Always. And I think you want a doctor to be thoughtful not only about making a precise risk estimate for you, where they might know that, you know, you don't fit into the categories of individuals, you know, neatly into the individuals who are used in defining either what's normal or what's your risk category. And so we want doctors to, and that's why thoughtful physicians are so valuable, right? That they understand how to individualize risk assessment. But I think there's something else that physicians do, and which makes physicians, you know, that physician you find that you really trust and you really, you know, you really, they really help you, is that they're not only considering those risks and those probabilities, but they're considering your own personal patient goals, right? And your values and which therapy they're talking to you about, what the benefits and harms are attached to each different therapeutic option. And they're really trying to understand whether you're someone who wants to maximize your health in a given state as long as possible, or whether you're willing to trade off some of the potential gains of a therapy for something that is just a better quality of life, or, you know, you name it. And I think we all have physicians like that, but I think it's going to be very important. You know, you're saying intuition. I think it's going to be very important to still, at least to me, I think, cement that part of the relationship between the doctor and the patient, and let them deviate in many ways from either what is there, or what is, you know, what might be kind of standard practice for a particular patient.
And then there's the cookie cutter approach, where you apply a formula and
it's attention, because I think standardization is important, guidelines are important, but we also want doctors who really know us and who really help us make an informed decision about what's appropriate. So I don't, you know, cookie cutter almost shifts it, right? From the, because it sounds bad, but yeah. guidelines also are, they have a big role and they're very important, but I do think we want physicians to individualize care for us and individualize treatment decisions for us as well.
Right. In order to violate rules, you need rules, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I have a general question about the research you do. You know, you work hard doing this research, and maybe you are fortunate enough to get your study published, say, in the New England Journal of Medicine or Lancet, and do you find that some studies are just simply ignored by the medical profession? I mean, is it a crapshoot, or, you know, is there a way of predicting whether your work will be taken seriously?
I mean, I have my thoughts. I would love to hear what James would respond to that. Yeah.
Right. So I think it's very interesting, because in my view, it's very different what is taken seriously by the medical community versus what ends up being taken seriously by the general public. And these are not always related. So for example, like if someone comes up with a brand new method to insert stents, or it comes up with this huge discovery that you can give some certain procedure 3 hours after a stroke, 4.5 hours after a stroke, instead of just 3 hours after a stroke, that's huge in the medical community, right? Because everyone knows it'll save lives. But then outside of that, people are like, oh, 3 hours, 4.5 hours, it's kind of hard to like explain the value of that. And so that's one example where it'd be a huge deal to one, but not the other. And then I'm sure there are plenty of other examples the other way around. And I think whether something gets attention is a function of so many things, including how well known the authors are, how well known the journal is, just how well the story is told in both the paper and in the news coverage of that paper. And so, for example, like that's why we're really excited to talk to folks like yourself, because being able to get the story right and understandable to so many people is a really core part of whether it actually ends up getting into people's inboxes and in front of and on people's minds, so that they can internalize and act on this type of knowledge. But there's so many factors that go into it. But Raj probably knows a lot more than I do, having published a lot more and been in the business longer than I have.
Yeah, I think James said it well. I think the distinction that James drew is between attention in two different and both very important communities. I also think, I guess I have been doing this for a little bit longer, but like I think it's still really hard to predict. And so I've learned humility both in predicting what lands in terms of getting through a medical journal's very rigorous process and multiple rounds of peer review and editing it and changing the story and adapting it for the journal itself. And then also it seems pretty hard to predict what will really resonate, I think, with many patients and physicians when we're doing this type of work, which, you know, we think is very clinically relevant. But I think whether it sort of gets immediate attention from the general public is also hard to predict. I also think there are many paths to impact. And so one is having immediate reach and getting attention right when the paper comes out. But there is profound impact, I think, in medicine in influencing those same guidelines that we just talked about a moment ago, and reaching that audience who's setting clinical practice or what is recommended clinical practice by the clinical societies. And so, for example, a few years ago, James published this really high impact paper in JAMA on the clinical implications of removing race from the kidney function equation. So similar in spirit to this lung function paper that we're talking about today, but focused on kidney function. And it's a long story and I won't go into the details, but suffice it to say that the way race is used in kidney function is quite different than the way it's used in lung function. The clinical outcomes are different. the focus of the paper, I think, intellectually, scientifically, is quite similar to what we're doing here, but the way it actually materializes is quite different. And so the paper did get some attention when it came out, but I think where the paper ended up having a lot of impact was through this task force that was formed between the American Society of Nephrology and the National Kidney Foundation. And we had published the paper, and to James's credit, he was lightning fast when we really needed data. And so it was, we had this stretch. Do you remember this, James, right? We're just meeting on Zoom all the time. And it was during COVID. And, you know, this is like, I think he was in Houston. I was in Boston. And he was at home and I was here at home. And, you know, Harvard is shut down at the time. And this is right when COVID hit. And then most of that summer, basically, 2020 summer. And so we had all these like late night Zooms and we're working a lot on this paper, got it out. And then it was in time where we were both able to brief the national task force that was making the decision on which equation is preferable, what approach is preferable, should be recommended nationally to move forward. And I really think there was impact there because it got to that audience and then it was cited and helped inform the way that they decided and ultimately made recommendations on a new equation that was refit without race as the way forward. So I guess I'll say yes. I think, you know, humility, hard to predict, but also several paths to impact here. And I think reaching those clinical bodies that are making the recommendations and the guidelines has been, I think, something that we've been pleased to see our work really kind of land in front of those groups. And so I think even at the American Thoracic Society meeting, one of the questions that we got in front of the audience, I think was from the first author of several of the main papers of the task force for lung function. And so I think engagement with those groups is very important. And our perspective is that the data inserted into those conversations can really help as well.
That was Harvard Medical School Assistant Professor Rajmon Rai and postdoctoral fellow James Diao speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosen.